Welcome to Giving an Answer, the show dedicated to defending the historic Christian faith. And I am your host,
Harold Felder.
And today I have with me a guest. The guest is Frank Turek, and he's going to be talking with me about the resurrection. Today we're going to talk about the resurrection, the historicity of the resurrection. Well, how do we know that the resurrection actually happened? Let me tell you a little bit about Frank. Frank has a master's degree in public administration. He has a master's degree in apologetics from Southern Evangelical Seminary, and he's almost completed his doctoral work, apologetics.
Same thing, yeah.
And he's assistant pastor at Southern Evangelical Church, Church I attend.
Where were you last week, man?
I was there.
You were all right.
Yeah.
I'm trying to keep tabs on you, man.
Okay. He's written two books, two award-winning books. I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, which is a great book, and Legislating Morality. He's been on a number of TV shows, The Rally Factor, Hannity and Combs, Politically Incorrect, and a number more. And now, today, he's on my show.
Giving an Answer, man.
Giving
I've been
answer.
On it before, too.
Yes, he's
put
you're becoming
that
a special
up the top
guest.
Of the
yes,
list
you're
there.
Right. You're becoming a regular.
That's right.
Okay, so let's get right in. Oh, you want to mention anything about your family?
Oh, yeah, I got a lovely wife, Stephanie, three boys, ages 17, 14, and 12.
Okay.
They know all this apologetic stuff because sometimes they go to seminars I give.
Oh, right. You give
cool.
a lot of them. Yeah. You speak a lot. You speak a lot around the area. Well, all over the country, actually.
A little bit. A little bit. Get around a little bit. Yep.
Yeah.
And so do you.
Well, maybe one day.
All right.
Okay, so let's get right to it all now. Right. We Christians, we know what we mean when we talk about the resurrection. But maybe not everyone knows even what we're talking about when we talk about the resurrection.
Yep.
So explain what a Christian means, what he's talking about when he talks about the resurrection.
That the body of Jesus that went into the tomb 36 to 48 hours later, probably 36 hours later, actually came out of the tomb after it was dead. It rose, walked out of the tomb, same physical body, albeit in a glorified state. And that body then later ascended into heaven after appearing to people on 12 different occasions. So the body that we all have, which is really falling apart, as the older we get, we realize that. And say, in fact, some people say we all get dresser disease when we get older. That's when our chest falls into our drawers, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And what happens is we get decrepit and our body actually goes back into the ground. But the Christian hope is that the body actually will be resurrected someday, just like Jesus' body was. And if you die before Christ comes back, you will be absent from the body but present with the Lord. But at one day, at the final resurrection, we will actually be risen. Our bodies will come out of the tomb and we will live in a glorified state in a physical body.
So you may have already touched on it, but why is the resurrection important to believers?
It's important to believers because what we lost in Genesis, we regain in the New Testament. We regain in Revelation. What happened with Adam and Eve, with the fact that they fell and their bodies then became mortal, we actually regain through the sacrifice Christ made in the New Testament. So Satan didn't win because the condition he put us in was only temporary. Jesus actually rescued us. In fact, I don't know, you probably a lot of your watchers here have seen the movie The Passion.
Yeah.
At the very beginning of The Passion, Mel Gibson does a great sort of way of portraying the very first prophecy in the Bible, Genesis 3:15, which basically says that the offspring of Satan and the offspring of Eve, or Satan and Eve's offspring, will have a war between one another. And while Satan will strike at the heel of Jesus, or the offspring of Eve, the offspring of Eve will crush Satan's head. And if you see the beginning of The Passion, it starts out when Jesus is in the garden and there's a Satan figure over there, and then the serpent comes out from the Satan figure and is sort of slithering over Jesus, who's in agony on the ground, and then he stands up, and what does he do? Stomps on the head of the serpent. And then you see the guards coming to take him to be crucified. In other words, at that point, he decided he's going through it. So he stamps on the head of Satan, and from that point on, it was over.
Now, I've heard you give this talk before, and I've actually seen you show the little clip that you're talking about. And I have a confession to make. I have not seen The Passion yet because I have not worked up the courage to see it.
Oh, man.
Because I know that once the credits come on, I'm going to start crying. And
I'm probably
never going to stop crying.
That's all right.
So, and I hear it's brutal. And I just haven't worked up the courage. But I did see a couple of little episodes of it,
Little clips, yeah.
Right. But at the end.
Uh-huh.
Now, the resurrection scene, yeah, where Jesus is in the tomb,
yeah,
the clothes just sort of like, you know, collapsed, like, right, he just became a mist or something. Is that scripture?
Well, no, he didn't become a mist. It says the grave clothes were lying there by themselves.
Uh-huh.
And whether he rose through them or took them off, probably he rose through them, but he was still a physical body.
Right.
He could still walk through walls and walk through doors because miraculously he could do so. But he was still a physical body. They touched him. They ate with him. They heard him. They saw him. He ate fish with them. So he said flesh and bones. Yeah. You know, I've got flesh and bones. You grab his hand, you'd feel it. He had the stigmata, they call it, or the scars, yeah, from the crucifixion in his wrists and, of course, in his feet. And, of course, he had, I'm sure, some scars on his head from the crown, so, and the side from the spear. So he was a physical body, but could he walk through? Yeah, of course he could.
This is a very important point, because I think a lot of people, when they think about the resurrection, they think that we're going to be raised in some kind of a spirit.
We will be before Christ comes.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Your loved ones die now, they're going to be resurrected to be absent from the body, but present with the Lord, not physically, spiritually, but in the last resurrection,
right,
those two are going to come together.
And that's the thing. When we are resurrected, our final resurrection is going to be in a physical body.
Sure.
Because if it's not in a physical body, then Satan won.
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
that's the whole point.
Right.
I mean, is that the same body, it has to be a one-on-one correspondence.
Yeah, yeah,
the same
yeah,
body that goes
yeah,
down
yeah,
to death has to be the same one
right,
as risen immortally.
Right, exactly.
Now, you've explained what the resurrection is. You've explained why it's important. Now, defend it. Defend the fact that the resurrection actually happened.
First of all, we got to deal with the question of miracles, because skeptics will look at the resurrection and say, well, it couldn't have occurred because it's a miracle. We've never seen anyone resurrected before. We talked about this on a previous show, but the greatest miracle of all in the Bible is not the resurrection even. It's not Jonah. It's not any of these other things we might think of. It's Genesis 1:1, that in the beginning, the universe exploded into being out of nothing. God spoke and it came into existence. If Genesis 1:1 is true, and all the evidence seems to suggest that it is, in fact, we talk about it in our book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. We have a whole chapter on what's known as the Big Bang, the cosmological argument, that the universe exploded into being out of nothing. Nothing. What's nothing? What rocks dream about, Aristotle
right,
said.
Right.
Nothing. So the entire space-time continuum came into existence out of nothing. All of nature came into existence out of nothing. Space, time, matter. Bang. Here it comes. That means there must be something outside of space, time, and matter that brought it into existence. Something outside of nature, i.e. something supernatural. And that being can't be time. It can't be in time because he created time. Can't be material because he created material. Can't be less than powerful because he created the universe out of nothing. So he must be powerful, must be intelligent, must be moral with the moral argument. I mean, this
right,
is the same. You can get the God of the Bible without looking at the Bible.
Right, right.
You know, you look at
look
modern
at
science and you look at the moral law written on our hearts. So if that's true, and evidence seems to suggest it is, more than suggest, seems to prove it is in my mind beyond a reasonable doubt, then a resurrection is certainly possible. Not only is it possible, Harold, it was predicted in the Old Testament. So miracles that we know about, like the creation of the universe.
What was it predicted in the Old Testament?
Well, I think the clearest prediction is Isaiah 53, when this suffering servant
yes,
then
right,
sees the light of life after he's dead. And we know the suffering servant's about Christ. Even the Jews used to believe that until they ran into Christian apologists about 1000 AD, and they started then to say, oh, no, the suffering servant's Jesus.
Right,
and there's a
right,
number of reasons it can't, I mean, it's Israel, a number of reasons it can't be Israel.
Right.
So it's about Jesus, and I think that's the best prediction of the resurrection is Isaiah 53.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's actual because the universe, we're here. I mean, the whole universe is a miracle. And it's predicted in the Old Testament. And then we say that eyewitnesses have seen it. So in context, the miracles of the New Testament are very believable. Because miracles are possible, because
yeah,
God exists, they're actual, because the universe is created, and they're predicted. So we ought to be looking for them.
Right. That's a good point.
Outside of that, I don't know much about this stuff.
So. Right. We've gotten miracles now.
Right. All right. Now, and what's the evidence? On a previous show, we probably don't have time to go into this again. We gave evidence that the New Testament documents are reliable, and we have early eyewitness testimony in the New Testament documents. We also pointed out that the non-Christian writers give basically the same storyline as the New Testament. And so we have a lot of archaeological data. We have data from non-Christian sources. We have the data from the Bible itself or from the New Testament writings themselves. And they all say
some of the data
Jesus,
from the extra biblical sources? Some of the data from some of the, like, well, I guess what, Tacitus and
Jesus? All right, well, we know Jesus died because the Jewish Talmud says that Yeshua was hung on a tree on the eve of the Jewish Passover for practicing sorcery and leading Israel astray. Jesus, they admit, was crucified, hung on a tree.
Right.
And they admit he did something unusual. They didn't call it miracles, they called it sorcery. Why? Because they couldn't say it was miracles. Why did you reject him then? You know.
Right.
There's other non-Christian writers that talk about it. There's archaeological discoveries that have shown us the fact that, for example, Pilate existed, that Caiaphas existed. In fact, we have Caiaphas's burial chamber, an ossuary.
Right.
That was discovered in Jerusalem in 1990. So not only do we know Caiaphas existed, we have his bones. So, and when we point out, and I don't have enough faith to be an atheist, there is over 30 figures in the New Testament that have been proven to be authentic characters in history outside the New Testament. Over 30 of them.
Yeah.
Folks like, as I mentioned, well, Jesus is mentioned outside the New Testament. So is John the Baptist. So is Pilate. So is Caiaphas. So is Felix. So is Festus. So all these people you read about in the New Testament, you can read about elsewhere.
One of the things that you mentioned in your book is the fact that you take these extra biblical sources and you basically paint a picture of Jesus. And the picture that's painted of Jesus is the same picture that we find in the Gospels of the resurrection.
Right. But not only that, Harold, I think another way we know that he did rise from the dead is the fact that when you look at the behavior of the scared, scattered, skeptical disciples before the resurrection, or at the crucifixion, and then after the resurrection, they suddenly become transformed. How do you explain that?
Right.
How do you explain how they would give up their 1,500-year-old religion overnight, virtually, give up all those things they thought they would go to hell if they gave up, like obeying the Sabbath, you know, the binding law of Moses, circumcision, all these things.
Animal sacrifices.
And now suddenly they give all that up and they go, you know, Jesus fulfilled all that, don't need to worry about any of that stuff anymore.
Right.
What happened?
Something major.
A major thing happened, because you don't just do that overnight, especially when you think that doing those things keeps you out of hell and not doing them sends you to hell.
Right, right.
So some big impact event must have occurred. And these folks all went to their death saying he rose from the dead. Don't you think one of them would have said, wait a minute. You know,
it was all a joke.
It was all a joke. We're just making this new club up and kind of got out of hand.
Right,
you know.
Right.
As you mentioned on the last show we did, many people will die for a lie they think is the truth, but nobody will die for a lie they know is a lie.
Right.
Now, the New Testament writers were in position to know whether it was a truth or a lie. They physically saw Jesus. They touched him. They ate with him. They were with him themselves, and they were the ones that went
and another
and
good point
for it.
Is James and Paul, because neither one of these were believers before, neither one. I mean, James, you know, he just thought Jesus was out there.
Right.
And Paul was actually persecuting the church. He was actually. So something must have happened to these two guys that made them completely turn around. Paul went from persecuting the church to being the apostle to the Gentiles. I mean, so and he writes in his writings. I mean, he makes it clear in his writings that the resurrection is what did it. I mean, he tells graphically of what happened when he was on the road to Damascus and how he saw the risen Christ. And we were talking before about, you know, 1 Corinthians, and he's writing. He's talking about 500 witnesses.
Yeah, right.
500
witnesses. He'd have lost all credibility if he had said 500 people saw him, and he's writing back to the church at Corinth. They would have said, that's not true.
Right.
And then he names 14 people right there who saw him. And if you look elsewhere in the New Testament, you get a total of at least 19 names, people who said they saw the resurrected Christ. And then, as you mentioned, another 500.
Right.
And, of course, the whole world, the whole ancient world there seemed to be transformed. Even Pharisee priests, a lot of people say, why didn't Jesus appear to the Pharisees? Well, you read Acts and you realize that Pharisee priests became believers in Acts chapter 6 and Acts chapter 15. Now, Luke would have lost all credibility with the Pharisees if he had said, you know, some of your own priests are believers. They'd have said, no, that's not right.
Right.
So this stuff really happened, man. Now, there's a lot of alternative theories to the resurrection.
Yeah, I want to get to that in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
But there was, I'm thinking of an incident. There were a couple of incidents outside the Bible that confirmed the story. For instance, like the earthquake that happened.
Oh, yeah. I think it was Phlegon that talked about an earthquake. In fact, I can find this in our book here. I don't have enough faith to be an atheist, because Phlegon says that there was actually a earthquake and an eclipse.
Yeah, yeah.
When it occurred, and I'd have to dig a little further in here, but it's in here.
And those aren't biblical sources.
Yeah, no, they're not.
These aren't even Christians necessarily.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's...
But even if you were to line up, well, who are you going to believe more, the non-Christian sources or the Christian sources? I'm going to believe the Christian sources more. Why? Because they had everything to lose by saying it was true from a temporal perspective. They got beaten, tortured, and killed for saying it was true. See, they had a motive to say it wasn't true.
Right.
I can't believe people will walk around saying, well, you can't believe the New Testament documents because they were written by converted people who had an axe to grind. The only axe to grind they had was to write down what they saw. If they had written down something they didn't see and said, here's the truth, and then they got beaten up for it, why would they do that?
Right.
You know, it just
doesn't
make any sense.
We know the church grew during... you know, intense persecution.
Oh, yeah.
Intense persecution.
In fact, the first 280 years of Christianity was basically illegal. It was in and out of persecution over those 280 years. The church really didn't officially begin till Constantine, officially meaning did it have state sanction, in about 317 A.D. or 314 A.D. It was way, way after.
And you had Roman emperors who were basically lining the streets with burning bodies of Christians, using them as lamps to light the city.
Yeah, Nero and Diocletian and... these folks wanted Christianity stamped out.
Yeah, yeah. But it still continued to grow.
It did.
And there must have been something very powerful behind
that. Right, right, exactly.
And that very powerful thing is the resurrection.
It's the only explanation that I see is plausible. And remember, we live in a theistic world where God exists and miracles are possible.
Right.
And that miracle was predicted. I didn't see any reason not to believe it.
Let's look at some of these alternative views then. All right, here's one. The disciples stole the body at night and took it to an unknown location.
That's the Jewish explanation that Matthew even talks about, right, in Matthew 28:15.
Yeah,
and they say the Jews to this day... that's their story. Now, it's a bad explanation when you think about it, because first of all, if you're a Roman guard and you fall asleep on watch, what happens to you?
You die.
You're dead. Secondly, if you are asleep and a Roman guard, how do you know what happened? I was asleep and I saw the disciples come and steal the body.
Right.
Well, come on.
Right.
But
the
disciples had no motive to steal the body. They had no ability to steal the body. In fact, they had every motive not to steal the body. Why would they steal the body and then say he was resurrected and then be beaten, tortured, and killed for saying he was resurrected?
Yeah.
What kind of sense does that make?
None.
Zero. Zip. Nada.
Then there's the view that the Romans or the Jewish authorities stole the body.
I don't know why they'd ever do that.
Yeah, that's the most bizarre.
Yeah, because they didn't want to see Christianity grow. It was a threat to them. They would have produced the body.
Right, exactly.
In fact, just about every other one of the objections you're about to bring up can be answered by saying, if that's true, why didn't the Romans or the Jews come and show the body, display the body?
Right.
Because they could have squashed Christianity right there in Jerusalem,
right,
where this whole thing started, by saying, look, here's the tomb. He's dead. Forget this whole thing.
Exactly. Now, this is a very popular one. It's called the swoon theory.
Well, it used to be popular. It's not anymore.
Okay. Christ was not dead when taken from the cross and placed in the tomb. I don't know if you may want to elaborate on exactly what the swoon theory
is. Yeah, swoon basically that he wasn't dead when he went in, and somehow he revived himself in that cold, dark tomb for 36 hours, pushed a 2-ton rock out of the way, up and away from the hill, overpowered the Roman guards, went bleeding to convince the scared, scattered, skeptical disciples that he had resurrected from the dead, then somehow did miracles and ascended to heaven and proved to them that he was God, even though he really wasn't.
That doesn't
make any sense, man.
I heard Gary Habermas sort of summarize this, mm-hmm. and he was like, okay, you've got Jesus in the tomb,
mm-hmm.
you know, so he's been beaten, he's been whipped, mm-hmm. you know, he's bleeding, he's got 70 pounds of, you know, because they had the
spices around him,
stuff.
Yeah.
So somehow he gets out of the tomb, you know, he's got, you know, he's bleeding profusely because he still has the, you know, the hands, the nails, marks, and so he's walking down the road and he's this bloody mess, and then he comes to where the disciples are, and they open the door and he says, it is I, you can have a resurrected body just like mine. And it was like, no, the first thing we're going to do is take you to a doctor.
That's
we're
right,
not going to follow you.
That's right.
You know, that's a very good
And it
point.
Doesn't take into account the spear in the side either. And when blood and water came out of the side, as John records it, that's an eyewitness detail. Why? Because we know today that a crucified victim would have water or a watery serum fill in the sac around the pericardium, the sac around the heart. So when the spear came in, out would come blood and what appeared to be water. And when John wrote it in John 19, he almost thought it was miraculous. He said, look, I saw this with my own eyes.
Right.
When what he was seeing was just basically a dead man have blood and a watery serum come out of his heart, just like we would expect a crucified victim to have.
Well, and another thing about that is that then we're charging the Roman guards, who are expert executioners, you know, that they didn't know when he was dead.
Yeah, they didn't even break his legs because they knew he was dead.
Right. And the whole method of crucifixion, I mean, in order to survive, you have to pull yourself up every so often to breathe. You can't breathe in the down position. Right. You have to pull yourself up. So if you don't pull yourself up for 2 minutes, you're dead.
Even if The Passion, the movie The Passion, was three times as brutal as it really was, still, I don't see how anyone could have survived it.
Right.
It's just, forget it.
Right.
Whipping, spear in the side, ain't happening.
Here's another one. The New Testament writers copied pagan resurrection myths.
Oh, that's so, one of my favorites.
They just borrowed from, you know, the stories of Osiris and all these other things.
First of all, most of those pagan resurrection myths come after the New Testament, not before, so it can't be the New Testament writers copying it. Secondly, Osiris, which did predate, Osiris isn't really resurrected. He just goes to the shadowy underworld. And the Jews, once again, would not create a resurrection story about a murdered Messiah, because they were expecting the Messiah to come in and free them from the Romans, not to be a sacrificial lamb. So it doesn't even fit with their paradigm. Thirdly, just because you have something that predates something else doesn't mean that the second story has been copied from the first. For example, the fictional show Star Trek predated the space shuttle missions. But that doesn't mean that news accounts of the space shuttle missions were copied from Star Trek episodes.
Right.
You know, I mean, it doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Just because it predates doesn't mean it's copied. And definitely the New Testament writers did not copy pagan resurrection myths. As I say, most of them were after, and only one or two of them were before, and they bear no resemblance to a resurrected Christ.
Now, this one is the one from Islam, and it basically says that Jesus didn't die on the cross, but it was only made to appear that he died on the cross, but someone else was substituted in his place, maybe Judas, a bunch of different theories about that.
Yeah, first of all, that not only goes against what the eyewitnesses saw, it goes against what even a witness hostile to Christianity saw, namely the Jewish Talmud, which says he was crucified, Jesus, Yeshua, was crucified. Not only that, you'd have to say that everybody at the crucifixion site was mistaken.
Yeah.
You know, even his mother was going,
Is
that Jesus? You think that's Jesus? Could that be, maybe that's Judas? I don't know. Why should we believe a story that comes around 600 years later, has no eyewitness import to it with regard to the Quran, rather than take what the eyewitnesses said and saw, or saw and said what happened, and then these folks, the eyewitnesses, went and died for it? I mean, why are you going to believe something 600 years late that has no authentication and disregard what the eyewitness said and saw?
Yeah, definitely sounds
saw
made
said.
Up. Here's another one. The witnesses went to the wrong tomb. It was dark. They went to the wrong tomb.
Oh,
the
tomb
that they went to was empty. You know.
Why didn't they go to the right tomb? Why didn't the Jews and the Romans go to the right tomb and produce the body? It was their tomb. It was the Jews' tomb. Joseph of Arimathea's tomb. I mean, it's been the wrong tomb for the past 2,000 years? I mean, that's just stupid. That's silly.
Yeah.
Hello, McFly. Forget it.
Okay, there's another one called the hallucination theory, that New Testament writers were just, it was some mass hallucination type thing going on.
Well, first of all, people don't have mass hallucinations, even if you're at Woodstock, okay? You don't have mass hallucinations. Suppose I came into here today, Harold, and said, hey, that was a great dream we had last night, wasn't it? You'd go, what? What are you talking about, man? A dream? You don't have collective dreams.
Right,
they're individual things.
Right.
Also, hallucinations can't explain the empty tomb. You see, the Jews or the Romans still would have gone to the tomb and produced a body, even if somebody was having an hallucination, and say, look, you're hallucinating. He's dead. Here he is.
Right.
See, so that doesn't explain that either.
Well, and another thing, it doesn't explain the 500 witnesses.
Nope.
It doesn't explain the ones who really weren't believers.
Right, yeah. It doesn't explain the appearances.
Right, right.
You know, the other thing you got to point out, too, about all these resurrection alternative theories, none of them, and I mean none of them, outside of the fact that they say the disciples stole the body, that's the Jewish explanation. By the way, that explanation presupposes what? That the tomb's empty.
You don't have
to come up with an explanation for an empty tomb unless it's empty. But that's none of them have first century evidence. They're all speculations. Right. I mean, you might as well just say, you know, a Martian came down and took Jesus out of there.
Yeah.
There's no evidence for it. You're just speculating.
Anyone can speculate anything.
You can speculate anything. What you have to do when somebody comes up with one of these theories is say, okay, that's a theory. Give me some first century evidence for it. You know what they're going to do? They're going to go, I don't have any first century
that's
evidence.
One of the things that, you know, sort of amazes me is like when we talk about things like the Da Vinci Codes and all these alternate theories, I mean, there's no evidence for them.
No,
but we're supposed to negate the clear evidence and believe in something that there was no evidence for, something fanciful.
Right. And not only that, but remember, this evidence is in context. There is a God. He created the universe. He predicted these things would happen. Then eyewitnesses come around and say they did, and then they go and die for what they said they saw. This isn't in a vacuum. This all makes sense.
Right.
This is all, when you put it all together, context is important to try and discover what happened.
Right.
You know.
A good point to make also is that the resurrection is the only thing. You look at all the evidence that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
You look at it, you know, the eyewitness testimonies. Mm-hmm. You look at the conversion of Paul and James.
Right.
I mean, you could probably come up with all kinds of various theories for, you know, each one of these little things. So you come up with all these like little miracle theories, but the only thing that really explains it, the only thing that really explains all of
the data,
is the fact that the resurrection happened.
Right.
That's the only thing that would truly explain it.
And you come up with all these little ad hoc things to try and explain, well, maybe Paul had some other experience, he hallucinated something, and maybe James did. But you can't say that about all of it.
Right.
You put it all together, and this guy actually rose from the dead as the Old Testament predicted he would.
And the bottom line is that the critics have to come up with an alternative. They have to come up with the next natural explanation.
Yeah, that's it. It's a bias.
Right.
It's like what the Darwinists do. They have a predisposition or a presupposition that only natural causes are possible.
Right.
That's a philosophical position. That's not a neutral position. They rule out a entire type of cause, an intelligent cause, before they even look at the evidence. That's what people who look at the resurrection do who are not believers. They say, well, it can't be an actual resurrection. There has to be another explanation. Well, that's a philosophical bias. That's not a scientific conclusion.
Right. Thanks again, Frank, for being on my show. Be sure to join me again next week. And until then, goodbye and God bless.
The preceding show has been sponsored by Giving an Answer with your host, H.C. Felder. So you can hear this broadcast as well as other episodes by visiting us online at givinganswer.org. You can also order a CD or a DVD of the studio recording by calling me at 704-248-7840. And remember, this show will only stay on the air if people continue to help us buy airtime. So I encourage you to consider making a tax-deductible financial donation to this ministry. That phone number again is 704-248-7840. And be sure to join me again next time on Giving an Answer.